From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In the hardest moments of the past month, I depended on the same band of brothers that I depended on some 30 years ago. We're a little older and a little grayer, but I'll tell you this, we still know how to fight for our country.
As John Kerry wins New Hampshire, moves to campaign in 7 state primaries next week, we'll continue with part 2 of our look at the Massachusetts senator. From Vietnam hero to Nixon's nightmare, an anti-war veteran, to his investigations into the Iran-Contra scandal. And then actor, director, activist Tim Robbins joins us in our studio.
You know what I was thinking about? Vampires. Maybe one day you wake up and you forget what it's like to be human. Maybe then it's okay.
He has just been nominated for an Academy Award for Mystic River, but we'll talk to him about a new play he's written and directed called Embedded, about U.S. media coverage of the invasion of Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Chicago Tribune is reporting the U.S. is planning a springtime offensive inside Pakistan involving thousands of special forces and ground troops in an attempt to target the Al-Qaeda network. One source told the paper this was, quote, not like a contingency plan for North Korea, something that sits on a shelf. This planning is like planning for Iraq. They want this plan to be executable now. The plans may have been accelerated after there were 2 attempts on the life of the Pakistani president, Pervez Musharraf. Publicly, Pakistani officials have rejected suggestions that it would allow the U.S. to carry out a major offensive inside Pakistan, but the Chicago Tribune quotes a well-placed military source who said, quote, "Before we were constrained by the border, Musharraf did not want that. Now we are told we're going into Pakistan with Musharraf's help." In Israel, 10 people died, 50 were wounded after a suicide bombing on a bus in Jerusalem today. The bombing occurred close to the official residence of the Prime Minister, General Ariel Sharon. The Palestinian group Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade claimed responsibility for the attack. It was the first suicide bombing in Jerusalem in 5 months. The bombing comes a day after Israeli forces invaded Gaza City, killing 8 Palestinians, including fighters with Islamic Jihad, and at least 4 civilians. David Kay, the former chief UN weapons inspector, said yesterday an independent investigation should be conducted into the flawed intelligence over Iraq's weapons capability. Kay said the intelligence was, quote, fundamentally flawed, but was not deliberately distorted. Kay's call came during testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. The White House dismissed the idea of an independent investigation and said inspections should continue. Kay also said he did not believe that the Bush administration had pressured intelligence analysts to exaggerate the threat, but leading Democrats disagree. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts said, quote, "Many of us feel that the evidence so far leads only to one conclusion, that what has happened was more than a failure of intelligence. It was the result of manipulation of the intelligence to justify a decision to go to war." Meanwhile, in Britain, a judicial inquiry has cleared Prime Minister Tony Blair of exaggerating intelligence claims about Iraq in the lead-up to the invasion. The inquiry, headed by Lord Hutton, blamed the BBC for airing what it described as unfounded allegations that the British government had sexed up intelligence about Iraq. In response to the Hutton report, BBC chair Gavin Davies submitted his resignation, and the BBC issued an apology for inaccuracies in its original report. The BBC's original report on May 29th led to a chain of events that resulted in the apparent suicide in July of David Kelly. Kelly was the British weapons expert who was identified as the source for the BBC story. The Hutton report is being widely viewed as a whitewash by critics of the Iraqi invasion. Parliamentarian George Galloway said, quote, "The establishment has exculpated the establishment from the crimes and blunders for which they were charged. The prime minister led us into a complete disaster. He is either a fool or a knave, either incompetent or a liar." In campaign news, Howard Dean has named a close friend of Al Gore's to be his new campaign manager. Longtime corporate lobbyist Roy Neal will replace Joe Trippi. The shakeup comes at a critical time for the former Vermont governor, who placed third in Iowa, second in New Hampshire. The campaign, which raised over $40 million, is now down to just $5 million. Campaign workers were asked to skip their paychecks for 2 weeks. After spending $2 million more in advertising than any other candidate, Dean is now the only one of the leading candidates without any ads airing. Trippi had been credited with revolutionizing the use of the internet in fundraising and organizing. He also helped build Dean's grassroots campaign. He's being replaced by a Washington insider who used to serve as president of the United States Telephone Association. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has authorized the Army to temporarily grow by 30,000 above the congressional approved limit of 482,000. Rumsfeld made the move using emergency authority granted by Congress after the September 11th attacks that allows the Pentagon to temporarily increase the size of the military without congressional approval. A secret FBI informant who'd been living in Detroit is charging that an FBI agent instructed him to break the law by spying on other Muslims and by stealing their mail. The informant, a Lebanese man named Marwan Farhat, made the charge in a January 21st letter that he wrote before he left the country after his identity as an informant was exposed. A copy of the letter was obtained by the Detroit News. The informant wrote, quote, "I worked around the clock helping and assisting the government of the United States to put Muslims in jail. My life has been destroyed, abused, and used to benefit your interests," unquote. Farhat originally became an informant as part of a plea bargain after he was arrested on cocaine charges. The Washington Post is reporting that the makers of the popular antidepressant drugs are refusing to disclose the results of clinical trials involving depressed children. Doctors say the studies may prove that drugs such as Paxil, Zoloft, and Effexor may cause children to become suicidal. Researchers familiar with the studies show that children who take the drugs did not get any better than children taking dummy pills. The drug companies say the studies are trade secrets. America, how are you? I'm just calling to check in. 'Cause lately you've not been yourself. I think you've forgotten something. Forgotten yourself, forgotten who you are. You become the midnight bully, standing up behind the bar, shoving dollars in your pockets, with bootleggers in the back. You got the cops out in the front room, making sure the decks are stacked. Think that you are winning, but this ain't no poker game. 'Cause you're not looking out the front door to see the ones who curse your name. 'Cause you've stolen and you've plundered in the name of liberty. Sold your soul to the highest bidder, and still you claim that you are free. So I'm calling to America by Erica Luckett here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator John Kerry is keeping up the momentum coming off his back-to-back wins in Iowa and New Hampshire. He picked up key endorsements in Missouri and South Carolina, two of the seven states with the most delegates up for grabs this coming Tuesday. In Missouri, two former senators, Gene Carnahan and Thomas Eagleton, endorsed his campaign. And in South Carolina, Kerry gained the support of Congressman James Clyburn, the state's top African African-American office holder and a former backer of Congressman Richard Gephardt, who quit the race for the presidential nomination after the Iowa caucuses. Today, part two of our look at the Massachusetts senator. Yesterday, we spoke about Kerry's formative years, his father a foreign service officer, his mother a member of the aristocratic Forbes family. He attended Swiss boarding school while his father was stationed in Berlin and was later sent to boarding school in St. Paul's in New Hampshire. He went to Yale University, where he was inducted into the university's secret Skull and Bones Society, an exclusive club in which just 15 Yale men are chosen each year. President Bush is also a member of Skull and Bones. After graduating Yale, Kerry volunteered for the Navy, went to Vietnam, served in the rivers of the Mekong Delta, was awarded multiple honors in the war, including three Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and a Silver Star. He returned from the war to join the growing anti-war movement, leading protests with Vietnam veterans against the war, becoming Nixon's worst nightmare, an anti-war veteran. Kerry testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he said, quote, "How do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?" Today, we are joined once again by Michael Cranish, who is a reporter for the Boston Globe, who was part of a team doing a seven-part series on Senator Kerry's life for the Boston Globe, recently back from New Hampshire. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Morning, Amy.
So yesterday, we left it at his Senate testimony, where he asked that question and talked about atrocities committed by U.S. soldiers in Vietnam.
That's right. And he became a national figure after that point. He was noted in the news. He was profiled on 60 Minutes. This was in April of 1971. He made the testimony, and he became appearing on a lot of television shows. He was on the Dick Cavett Show, on Face the Nation and Meet the Press and shows like that. And in fact, there was the White House very much wanted someone who was also a Vietnam vet to start talking about in favor of the war. And as it happened, there was a man who did want to talk in favor of the war, who had served in a similar outfit as Kerry. And this man started debating Kerry on shows like the Dick Cavett Show. And it's very interesting. If you watch that show, it's a tape from 1971, you really get a sense of John Kerry sounding and looking quite a bit different from today. He sounds sort of like he's got a JFK, as in Kennedy, accent, which he no longer has today, and very strongly going after those who would support the war. And he would appear with very large briefing books and basically make the case that atrocities occurred in Vietnam, and that all the people who participated basically were responsible for that, especially those in the administration. He blamed the Nixon White House and the top officials of the Nixon administration.
And what about his role in Vietnam veterans against the war? It was controversial, sort of swooping in, then swooping out.
Yes. Well, as we started to talk about yesterday, Amy, he helped create this organization, but it already was in existence. He came in. I do think it's fair to say that both he saw this group as an opportunity for him to come in and use that group to espouse his opposition to the war. Also, I think it's fair to say some people within the organization who were savvy saw Kerry as the perfect spokesperson. They realized that a lot of those people who were in the organization may not look or sound that appealing to certain elements of the country they were trying to appeal to. In other words, they could preach to the choir, no problem, but they really wanted to convince middle America that this was a bad war. And some saw Kerry as the perfect spokesperson for that. He was very well-spoken. He looked like a relatively clean-cut person. He wore his uniform sometimes, or his certain things that certainly gave an appearance that this was a young officer, not just an enlisted man who was sent over there, but an officer who volunteered for duty, saw what happened there, believed there were atrocities occurring, believed the war was wrong and unnecessary, and came back and helped lead a protest against it. So he was able to very quickly become on good terms with senators, for example, Senator Ted Kennedy, who helped him quite a bit, other senators on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, whom he testified before. And he also was very good at organizing. He learned in 1971, as a leader of this organization, how to organize, how to raise money, So it all was setting the stage for political campaigns that he ran and is still running throughout his life. So he learned an awful lot about that. After a period of time, there were those in the organization that basically felt, you know, this guy was taking over. There were some in the organization that, you know, from what I read of histories and so forth, that they wanted the organization to basically change the entire government or our style of government. They were much more to the left than some others. And these people didn't want Kerry there. They thought he was too, quote, mainstream, unquote. And so after a relatively short period of time, Kerry and the organization did part ways. But the history is that at the organization's apex, Kerry was a key leader.
You talk about Nixon's response to him, talking to his Secretary of State Kissinger about Kerry, asking whether what he was saying was true in Vietnam, and then the issue of the famous act of hundreds of veterans who threw their medals or ribbons back at the administration.
That's right. I went to view some of the video from 1971 to see what actually happened. I wasn't there. I think I was in junior high school at the time, so I certainly remember this happening. I grew up in Washington, D.C., so I remember the protests happening downtown and so forth, but I was not there. Another reporter, actually, who's still in our office, our bureau, Tom Oliphant, was there, you know, was with Kerry on these days, and I read his clippings, also had a chance to see the news footage from the time, and the scene was in front of the Capitol steps. They had set up this sort of fencing area, like a small gated area, and someone had put a sign that said trash, and then you saw Vietnam vets go up and they would deposit their ribbons or their medals, things like that, in there. They'd throw them over, speak to the news media that was gathered, and then walk away. Kerry, at certain times, it's been reported he threw his own medals. He won a Silver Star, a Bronze Star, three Purple Hearts. It's been reported at certain times that he threw his medals over. He later said, no, it wasn't his medals. It was someone else's medals. A vet had given him the medals, and he threw those and his own ribbons, but not his own medals, which he says he still has. So in any case, however you look at it, he was a very ardent protester, no question about it, and this certainly got the attention of the White House. And as I started to say yesterday, this got the notice of the White House, and if you listen to the tapes that are at the National Archives here just outside of Washington, there's a conversation, for example, where Charles Colson on April 28th is speaking with President Nixon, and Colson tells the president, this fellow Kerry they had on last week. Nixon responds, yeah, he turns out to be quite a phony, Colson says. Nixon responds, well, he is sort of phony, isn't he? And it goes on like that, and Colson scoffs about Kerry. He says he was only in Vietnam a total of 4 months. It's not really true. He was there for two tours. And then Colson says, he's politically ambitious, just looking for an issue. And Nixon responds, yeah. And Colson says, he came back a hawk and became a dove when he saw the political opportunities. Sure, Nixon responds, well, anyway, keep the faith. That's one of numerous conversations that Nixon has with his top aides about John Kerry. So as you can imagine, for a reporter, it's very interesting to listen to these conversations. When I interviewed Senator Kerry for this project, he was not aware of these conversations, had never heard the tape. So it's quite interesting to talk about them, just as I have with you.
We're talking to Michael Cranish of the Boston Globe. We're going to break and then come back and look at his first failed race for Congress, the issues raised with him there, and then his spearheading the investigation into the Iran-Contra scandal and his relationship with Oliver North, two men, both vets, 3 months apart. Stay with us. Thank you. the Art Ensemble of Chicago. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On the line with us is Michael Cranish, who is a reporter for the Boston Globe, involved with a 7-part profile of John Kerry about his life. We've talked about his anti-war activism. He comes back, and then he pretty abruptly leaves Vietnam Veterans Against the War and decides to run for Congress. Michael Cranish, can you pick it up there?
Yes, he did want to run for Congress. He had thought about this for quite a while. But when he got to the point of actually picking a race in Massachusetts, he found that there were others who were already there ahead of him. And I'll make this very quick. He basically was unsuccessful, did not win the primary, so thus didn't run in the general. So he was not successful in that. And he went on to other things. He was not successful in his first effort, so he's known failure in his political career. But he wasn't actually... He didn't get to the point in that race of actually getting before the voters. This was an inside-the-party thing. He thought his notoriety as an anti-war activist, which was certainly a popular sentiment at that point in Massachusetts, would be enough, but it wasn't, and he learned that lesson right there.
His next move.
And then he went on, and Amy, I wrote we had a 7-part series. I wrote the first 3 parts, and now we're in the area where of the parts that I did not write. So I'm going to ask you to go along and ask me certain questions you want me to address.
Well, when he won and became and made it to Congress, one of the things he's very well known for is investigation into the Iran-Contra scandal. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about taking on Oliver North, taking on the Reagan administration, going to Nicaragua, and actually forming an alliance with Jesse Helms?
Well, yes, I think some of his opponents have made quite a point that he has not got a lot of legislation under his name, that you're hard-pressed to say the Kerry bill for such and such. You're much more likely to say the Kennedy bill, because obviously Senator Kennedy is a senior senator and he does a lot of the authoring of legislation. Kerry, as a former prosecutor, we skipped over that, but he was a former prosecutor, and as he points out, he put people... some people in jail for life and so forth. As a former prosecutor, he is a very inquisitive person, an investigative natured person. So he was very interested in conducting investigations, and given his background of what he had learned about his belief that the government had basically misled the country about Vietnam, he wanted to see as a senator whether he could find out whether similar things were going on. So I think he saw that as his role as a sort of watchdog of the government, and he did learn about certain things. For example, with Iran-Contra, there was, before this became a huge public issue, there was an investigation done by his staff, not necessarily a big formal investigation. We think of the big Iran-Contra investigation by the Senate. That came much, much later. This was something done by him and his staff. He had quite an aggressive staff that would look at things on their own, and then they could hold hearings or he could hold press conferences. And he had heard rumors about Oliver North, what he was doing, and Oliver North's work with the Contras. And interestingly, he and North are sort of opposite characters. North had served in Vietnam and was very, very supportive of the war. And, of course, Kerry had served in Vietnam, was very opposed to the war. And then some years later, they come and face off in Congress. And Kerry did make various statements about Oliver North and what he felt North was doing. And eventually, this and other things, I can't say this is the reason that Iran-Contra became a public issue, but this and other things led to the exposure of Iran-Contra and then the downfall of Oliver North before he went on to become a media figure.
It also meant taking on the Reagan administration and their core policy of supporting the Contras in Nicaragua, who had killed thousands of people, and then getting Jesse Helms on board saying that the Contras were involved with drug running.
Drug running, right.
And Jesse Helms.
At the time, and actually I was a reporter who covered some of this contemporaneously, and, to set a little bit of the stage, John Kerry did meet, for example, with the leader down there in Nicaragua, and this was controversial. If you look on our Globe website with the series, you'll see a photo that I'm talking about right there. And Kerry and his staff had heard rumors that the Contras, in part to finance their operations, were also running drugs, and that we might be helping Contras who were then transporting drugs that would then come back into this country. It was a charge that was pretty, quote, out there, unquote. And at the time, even a lot of people who believed in what Kerry was saying thought this was a little bit much. And some people felt it was undermining his overall investigation because it was such a extraordinary charge, and implication being that perhaps even our own CIA was somehow helping these people run drugs. Later, Kerry has said his charges were vindicated by various government reports. That's a whole other show that perhaps you'll want to do with another reporter at some point. But he does believe that, in fact, those allegations were justified and have in various ways proven to be true. There's a lot of back and forth. You can have guests who would argue it both ways, so I want to be very fair in describing that, and that's not a piece that I particularly that I was the author of.
Right. It's interesting to see the controversial picture of John Kerry shaking the hands of Ortega in Nicaragua with Tom Harkin, another freshman senator who now is supporting Howard Dean, but went with John Kerry to Nicaragua. And it looks like the administration took him on for going to Nicaragua to support the government there in the same way that the Bush administration took on people like Congressman McDermott when he went to Iraq.
Well, in this case, yes, that photo, which I don't believe I had never seen it published before, and that was a case of we try to do investigative journalism, and that was a case of an editor doing a little bit of investigating of his own, and they found that photo. I believe it was from a Nicaraguan newspaper or website or someplace like that, where they had where we couldn't find this photo in our own archives. But it turned out in Nicaragua, there was this photo. Would not surprise me at all if Kerry is a nominee that we'll see this photo again for those who this means something to. So yes, but you know it's the whole contra investigation.
But Ortega was the president.
I'm sorry.
Ortega was the president.
Well, he wasn't the favorite of the administration at the time.
Also, as is written in the series of pieces in the Boston Globe, in an offshoot of the Contra drug investigation, Kerry examined reports that Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega was involved in drug trafficking. The probe led to information that Noriega was shipping money out of Panama with the help of a bank called BCCI, which prompted yet another Kerry investigation. BCCI was an international bank of Middle East origins whose employees asked few questions of their wealthy and powerful customers, making it a favorite of arms merchants, drug dealers, despots such as Noriega, and intelligence agencies. At the CIA, which sometimes used the bank to launder its own activities, it was known as the Bank of Crooks and Criminals. Kerry's investigation helped to close the bank 3 years after the investigation began in 1988.
Right. This bank, the investigation caused him some indigestion because there were certain Democrats, powerful Democrats, who had done work or were affiliated in some way or other with BCCI. So it caused him certain problems as a result of that. He did go through with that, but as is written in our series, there were certain Democratic senators who'd come up to Kerry and would note that Clark Clifford, the Democratic power broker, had some affiliation with BCCI, and they'd ask Kerry, what are you doing to my friend Clark Clifford? But Kerry did stay on that investigation. Clifford did come to the witness table, but basically he was 84 years old at the time, was not given a particularly tough grilling. But that is certainly one of the investigations that Kerry is best known for here in Washington.
It was not only Clark Clifford and Democrats, but certainly the Bush family has had ties, along with a number of other Republicans, to BCCI. A story written by, among many other people, Kevin Phillips, his new book, American Dynasty, The Links.
I didn't write this particular story, so I can't speak to that.
One thing we skipped over, Michael Cranish, was the period before he became senator, when he was lieutenant governor for Michael Dukakis. And when you look at the way this race will be played out, that's an interesting period and relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of the Bush administration wanting to raise the connection between Kerry and Dukakis.
Well, I think you'll certainly see the Dukakis-Kerry picture prominently displayed if Kerry is the nominee, or even right now, as he's not, already you've had the Republican officials come out and say, you know, Kerry is actually to the left of Ted Kennedy. I can't tell you if that's so, but that's what they're saying, and they'll certainly draw the connection once again. Having covered Michael Dukakis, having covered John Kerry, they were governor, lieutenant governor together. They're also very, very different people. They may share, you know, various political instincts. They're both from Massachusetts and so forth, but they're very different in their political styles. Dukakis has told me and others many, many times that he didn't fight back effectively when he ran for president against George Bush Sr. in 1988, and that he has certainly told Kerry that's what he has to do, and you know, no doubt that Kerry would certainly take that advice. That's his instinct. If you've watched his campaigns, he is, especially in a general election contest, very vigorous in that, so it'll be very interesting to see if it turns out he is the nominee.
Michael Cranish is a reporter with the Boston Globe, involved with a seven-part series looking at the life of John Kerry. I'd like to switch gears now to Wesley Clark, who eked out a third place finish over John Edwards in the New Hampshire primary. You did a two-part series on Wesley Clark, looking at the general taking on his next battle, and that is for the presidency of this country. And I was wondering if you could give us a thumbnail sketch of Wesley Clark's life.
Well, Wesley Clark, he was born in Chicago. His father died when Wesley Clark was 4 years old. His father was Jewish. His mother was not. And his mother moved back to Arkansas, where she was from, to Little Rock, and eventually remarried a man who actually turned out to be an alcoholic and essentially lost his job. And I've been to the small little bungalow house in Little Rock where Wesley Clark grew up. And it was a modest home. It was not a upper-class life. But, you know, somewhat comfortable. Little Rock was a very insular town. He grew up at a time of the segregation and desegregation crisis of Little Rock. And he went to a high school, not Central, but another high school called Hall, a year or two after the Central controversy and so forth, trying to integrate that. So he went to Hall High School there, and there were in the, I believe it was three or four grades in that particular high school, there was one African-American in each of the classes. Interviewed the, I think there were three women, as I recall it from my interviewing, three African-American women who were in that high school at the time. He went, none of them really knew Wes Clark. The two of the three that I did reach said they remembered him, that he basically, you know, was a nice person, but, you know, did not engage them. It just, you know, he was just there. He was a very smart student. He was a star swimmer and so forth. And he had decided that he wanted to go into the military, and he did. He went to West Point, whereas probably a lot of people realize he was first in his class. He joined the debate team there. He went on to become a Rhodes Scholar, and this was during the time of Vietnam. So his class at West Point, a lot of them went on to Vietnam. He went over to Oxford to be a Rhodes Scholar. Had some, I think, guilt over the fact that some of his friends were there and some of his friends were dying in Vietnam, and he was there in Oxford. One of his unusual jobs in Oxford was the U.S. government asked him to go around to places in England to defend the policy of the Vietnam War, and Wes Clark did do that. He did then go over to Vietnam. He served in a sort of bureaucratic position for 4, 5, 6 months in Vietnam. And then he, as a captain, did take command of a group, which varied in size, but it might have been as much as 100 people. But typically it was a smaller subgroup of that. And the area he was in was not seeing a whole lot of action at the time he was there. If I have my dates correct, I think this was actually a little bit after Kerry had left Vietnam. They did not intersect in Vietnam, didn't know each other there. But at some point, there was an incident in which Wes Clark was with just a couple of guys, and there was an ambush. Basically what happened was Clark was going up a little rise in the landscape, and suddenly he heard something, and he said, "They're in there," and shrapnel came out, and he was wounded in four different places. So he never got to fire a shot. He was basically walking along and was hit. He was seriously wounded. And there is a gentleman, one of the three or four other soldiers who was with him, who basically, as far as I can tell, saved his life. This gentleman Clark had not spoken to him since the day this incident happened more than three decades ago. And I was able to track him down in Michigan and talk to him. And then I also read the records in the archives. And it's clear to me, I'm convinced from my own research, that this gentleman saved Clark's life. He dragged him back. He shot out at the enemy. He himself won a medal for what happened that day. And Clark's radio man basically radioed to the base that we needed a helicopter. And a helicopter came in, and they had one of these long cords that come down, and they were able to put Clark in this device on the pulley and pull him up to the helicopter and bring him to the hospital. So that is his military action, not to take anything away from a man who was wounded seriously and was hit in four different places. It was a few minutes of combat. This was a little different than Kerry, who was basically in combat situations almost every day for 4 months. So it was a different experience. As it turned out, Clark was much more seriously wounded than Kerry was. Kerry got three Purple Hearts, but all those were pretty minor wounds. Two of them didn't cause Kerry to miss any service. One of them caused Kerry to miss a day or two. And Clark, by contrast, was just in combat for a few minutes and was quite seriously wounded and has wounds that even to this day cause him certain problems. So that's just the way it happens in combat, obviously. Clark had what is known in the military as the million-dollar wound. He was too serious for him to continue in combat, but it wasn't life-threatening in any way. He came back. It took about as close to a year of rehabilitation, but he's basically back on his feet. And he decided he took a different road than John Kerry. It's very interesting to contrast these two men. Both went to Vietnam, both in the military. Wes Clark, the same time Kerry was out there, you know, protesting against the war, Clark had decided he wanted to make his career the military. Mm-hmm. He went back to the comfortable confines of West Point, and he taught political philosophy. And over a long period of time, we could talk about this for quite a long time, but he basically rose steadily through the ranks. There were always those, as Wes Clark will tell you, who felt, you know, he's just a, you know, that he was not the type of military person that some people like. Some in the military preferred someone who, you know, wasn't an intellect, and Wes Clark certainly was more the intellectual sort as a Rhodes Scholar. And that turned off some people in the military and turned on some people in the military. Suffice it to say, to wrap this up, there were enough people who liked the fact that he was who he was as an intellectual officer, that he did rise steadily through the ranks. And eventually there came a time when he did know Bill Clinton. He'd actually met Bill Clinton back in the 60s. They weren't great friends or close friends, but they knew each other, and I think more importantly, they knew of each other. They'd followed each other's careers as each had gone on successfully. So Bill Clinton had risen to the White House. Wes Clark had risen quite steadily in the military, and Clinton helped ensure that Clark got certain positions that eventually led Clark to become the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, and we can talk about that. But that brings you up to what he's best known for, which is his position in NATO.
Also putting him head of the Southern Command over another general who was preferred by the military, and that resentment, the division between the State Department and the Pentagon as he moved into dealing with Bosnia and being head of the NATO forces, where he was allied with Madeleine Albright and President Clinton, as opposed to the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Hugh Shelton. He was more friendly with his predecessor, Shalikashvili.
Yes, in this case, it's sort of the opposite of what we have today in Iraq. There was a perception, fair or not, that the State Department was much more reluctant to go into Iraq and that the Pentagon was much more hawkish and so forth. In the case of the Balkans, the Pentagon under Bill Cohen did not want to go to war in the Balkans, I think it's fair to say. And the State Department under Madeleine Albright basically did, wanted to put a lot of pressure on and, did go to war, did, you know, back that. And it was important to the State Department, since the Pentagon was not on board, to have another top military person, Wes Clark, on board. And so the State Department worked very closely with Clark, and this really angered those at the Pentagon. And that is what, in part, prompted the Pentagon leaders to oust Clark after the Balkans. Some people, you know, ask, well, he was successful in the Balkans. They won the Kosovo War with not a single U.S. soldier killed in action, and yet he was ousted thereafter. Why would that be? And the reason was that they were just, A, they didn't really want to go wage that war, and B, they're unhappy in the way that Clark works so closely with the State Department and put them off. In fact, this is a quite long story unto itself, and Wes Clark wrote a book of, I think it's close to 500 pages, Waging Modern War. And in that book, he talks at very great length about his disputes with the Pentagon. In fact, most of the book seems to be a defensive explanation as to why he was ousted when he was ousted.
And the famous moment when he demanded that the British general head off the Russian troops. Can you describe that?
Well, in that case, he describes it at length in his book. There are other people in their own recollections who describe it somewhat differently. But he was concerned, after all the work that had been done by the U.S. to win this war in Kosovo, that the Russians would simply come in and say, thank you very much, we're now going to take over this part of Kosovo and put it under our control. And to Wes Clark, you know, he felt, from his point of view, we've been there before. We've seen when the Russians have come in, you know, after a joint military action or something like that and taken over. I'm not comparing it to what happened in East Germany, but these kind of things will go through a commander's mind. Other officials, the British officials, said, you know, really not to worry, we've got it under control, they're not going to, you know, do what you're concerned about. And there was a perception by a British military official that Clark was suggesting that the Russians be forcibly kept out of a certain area, the airfield area in Kosovo. And this person famously said, I'm not going to start World War III for you, to Wes Clark. Clark has said, you know, that's really not fair. He wasn't suggesting that there be any kind of military action, but that he wanted the British, who had control over this certain area, to either block a road or do something to prevent what he was concerned would be a post-war disaster. Things worked out. You know, there wasn't that confrontation, so it all worked out in the end. But that's certainly quite a startling quote to read about World War III.
Well, Michael Cranish, we're going to leave it there. We will continue to look at the candidates that are running for president in this country. Michael Cranish, the columnist or the reporter for the Boston Globe, spoke with him yesterday in Nashua, now back from covering the New Hampshire primary. I want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
And you can go to the Boston Globe website to look at the pieces on Wesley Clark and John Kerry. When we come back, Tim Robbins will join us, just nominated for an Oscar Award, just won the Golden Globe Award. We're going to talk about a new project he's involved with. It just came to New York from Los Angeles. It's his play, Embedded. Stay with us.
I was fresh out of the service. It was back in 82. And I raised some cane when I come back to town. I left to be all I could be. Come home without a clue. I married Dawn and had to settle down. So I hired on at the prison. Guess I always knew I would. Just like my dad and both my uncles done. And I've worked on every cell block now. And things are going good. But then they transferred me to LSU. Talk about them long nights at the walls and how they used to strap them in the chair. And the kids down from the college and they'd bring their beer and all. And when the lights went out, the cheer rose in the air.
Steve Earle here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Bull Durham, Jacob's Ladder, Bob Roberts, Shortcuts, The Hudsucker Proxy, Shawshank Redemption, Dead Man Walking, Cradle Will Rock, and now Mystic River. Tim Robbins joins us today. He has just been nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Mystic River, and last Sunday he won the Golden Globe Award. These are just some of the films that Tim Robbins has made, has been involved with, one of the biggest stars in Hollywood over the last decade. He and his partner Susan Sarandon have also become two of the leading war voices, anti-war voices in Hollywood. Both been vocal in their opposition to the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, and also the corporate media's coverage of that invasion. Tim Robbins' latest project is directing a play and writing it called Embedded, about journalists and the U.S. military personnel during the invasion of an oil-rich rogue state called Gomorrah, ruled by a, quote, butcher of Babylon. One review says the play, quote, skewers cynical embedded journalists, scheming government officials, and a show-tune singing colonel in the media's insatiable desire for heroes. The show has been in Los Angeles. The production from Actors Gang, the company Robbins ran, runs in Los Angeles, and now is opening in New York at the Public Theater on February 24th. We welcome Tim Robbins to Democracy Now.
Thanks for having
it's
me.
Good to have you with us. Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks. How did it feel?
Well, it feels a lot better than not getting it. it was a good time. Yeah, it was fun because I was first, so I could just relax.
Bill O'Reilly on Fox actually had a positive thing to say about you. He thought that you acted very well in Mystic River and was very glad that when you got up and gave your little acceptance speech for the Golden Globe Awards that it was not political.
Well, glad I could please him one day out of his life.
So you're getting a lot of attention from Mystic River, but you have this new production that I got a chance to see in Los Angeles when it was still in its very beginning phases, Embedded. It is a powerful indictment of both the invasion, but particularly the media's coverage of it. Can you talk about how this play came into being?
Well, I was, during the war last year, I was doing most of my research or reading or news gathering either through this show or through the internet with reading The Independent and The Guardian in London, because having had just recently been there before the war started, I realized that England has still has a free press that does criticize and question its government. And coming back here to see the cheerleading that was going on was really disheartening. The good news is, though, you can get that information on the internet, and you don't have to be a slave to some of these television stations that kind of distort the news. And I think everyone kind of knew at the time what everyone's finding out now in the major media. And that's the tragedy that we're dealing with, is that we don't have a tough enough Fifth Estate.
You weave a lot of stories into this, and you take, it seems, a lot of, was it direct transcripts of embedded reporters, also unembedded reporters?
Yes, I did. There is some direct quoting from both really great journalists like Robert Fisk and John Simpson and Alan Fuhr from the Times, who went over there and wrote a beautiful piece on a graveyard. But there's also, you know, direct quotes from the Fox people and their kind of cheerleading
quotes. You're upsetting
quotes.
Mr. Yeah. O'Reilly. He might not let you on his show now that we've given you a few more minutes than the Golden Globe.
There's also, you know, it's not just the bad, it's also the good. I mean, there are a couple characters in the play that are journalists with integrity that are trying to get things through, and a lot of them did get things through. Sometimes you had to look in the back pages of the Times to find it, but, you know, some of them did get some very human reporting through. And so I tried to mix those and also tell the story of some of the soldiers that were there through the prism of the media and their kind of insatiable desire to make instant heroes out of some of these men and women.
And their relationship with the military.
Yes, they're... a couple of the journalists are more than willing to write whatever they want, but there are a couple that do fight against the censorship.
And in the background, through your play Embedded, you've got the Jessica Lynch story running.
Yeah.
The young woman who was gravely injured in Iraq, and then the Pentagon put out the story that they had saved her, arrested her from enemy forces at a hospital.
Right, which and that kind of fiction lingered for a while. And it's interesting because I read right away, I think 2 weeks later, in The Guardian, they had sent a reporter to the hospital to talk to the doctor and a couple of nurses and found a whole different story. But that was available immediately, you know, to people that really...
Even before the BBC did a big expose.
Oh, yeah. It was there on the internet.
On Democracy Now!, soon after, we had those reporters from the British newspapers just simply reporting, going to the hospital and what they had found. Most people in this country, I think, the vast majority, if polled on this, would say that they thought Jessica Lynch was wrested from enemy hands. It's a story that Jessica Lynch herself doesn't even tell.
Yeah, it's interesting, and in our play, it's a satire. Her name is Jen Ryan, and she's Private Ryan, and the story that it's parallel. It's not exact, but one of the most interesting things about the whole whitewash of it, so to speak, was the. When she got back with the parade, and she said, "I love you," to this gentleman, and with forgot his name, Gonzalez, I believe, and they immediately qualified it when they got back on the air, saying that, "Oh, that must be the physical therapist that worked with her in the Washington hospital." Could not accept the fact that she might have had a romantic relationship with a Latino, and so it was. The combination of this and the combination of this outrageous story they tried to put on us, in a desire at that time to try to create some good news for us. It's a gray area, though, because they didn't need to do that. There were soldiers in that hospital 2 days before they did the raid. So there was a possibility that there were soldiers there. There was no need to cook up this big story. There was enough of a story there. But it's interesting. There's some creative writers that are they're working on the way things are spun.
So you have these two tracks. You're getting tremendous attention in Hollywood right now. We'll be going to the Academy Awards. And you have this play that you've done, which started off real small in Los Angeles. I saw it behind Actors Gang in your more, experimental studio with about 15 people. Then it went to Actors Gang, and it totally sold out. What kind of media reception are you getting from the very papers that did a lot of the Embedded reporting?
Some very good reviews. I guess that's a different Embed. There's the Embed on the front page, and there's the Embed in the drama department. What I found was really interesting about it was that there was such an overwhelming, enthusiastic response to it. When we first did it in that little space, I really had no idea what was going to happen. I thought people might throw things. I really didn't know because it was so fresh and it was right out of the headlines. And what we found was this kind of, there's different energies that happen when you're doing a play, but there's this rare one that happens, this kind of kinetic, kind of electric thing that happens sometimes where people are laughing, but they can't believe they're laughing. Or there's a kind of response that is half fear and half laughter. And that was really palpable in the spaces that we did in Los Angeles. And exciting, you know, and a little dangerous, too. And that was where we realized that maybe this has more of a life than just Los Angeles, and so we're going to do it at the Public Theater starting on the 24th of February, and the whole company is coming from Los Angeles. I'm bringing them all, and I hope it goes well.
So this is an interesting time. You've been nominated for Best Supporting Actor in Mystic River. Sean Penn has been nominated for Best Actor. Sean Penn is just back from another trip to Iraq, who got skewered in the by some of the corporate media when he first went to Iraq, saying he was cozying up to the enemy. Mm-hmm. What about your conversations with Sean Penn? And what's going on here? The leading actors in this country taking a very different view of the establishment.
I think that you'd find that the majority of, well, not, I don't know the majority, but a good deal of people in Hollywood would feel the same way. It's just that I guess Sean and I are, I guess, more predisposed to speaking our opinion publicly than others are. And but I think you would find a wide agreement, not only in Hollywood but across America, that there's something really, really wrong with the way we went to war.
We last had you here, I think, over the Cooperstown controversy, Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame, where they disinvited you and Susan Sarandon. They were celebrating Bull Durham, but then because of your anti-war comments, and you took them on. Overall, do you find the response to you just from the public is more positive than we're seeing in the mainstream media, that the mainstream media doesn't reflect the mainstream?
No, I don't believe at all that they do. All I can tell is that walking down the streets of New York, it's been overwhelmingly positive. You know, I get nothing but support. I mean, a couple people, a little grouchy in the last 8 months, two people. It's not bad odds, you know, compared to the hundreds that have been very supportive.
Do you want to practice your acceptance speech here for the Academy Award? Give us no, a kind
I'll
of dry
on,
run.
I'll knock on your wood, though. Hey, don't forget to say the play's funny, Amy.
The play is in part hysterical. And what do you hope people take away from it? This ensemble production of the various scripts and transcripts and of this not so fictional place.
I hope they take their programs with them. It's hard to say what you want someone to think or feel. You know, I just hope that there's questions raised and that people leave a little more engaged than they were before. But not in any kind of, you know, I don't believe theater should be a classroom or a lecture hall. I think the first thing we have to do when we're doing theater is make entertainment. And so it's really important for me to find the humor, but also to raise the questions. And if the audience leaves a bit entertained, but also a little bit disturbed or angry, I think that's good.
When you wrote it, you may have thought, well, if this has any life, it will not be relevant very soon. And yet, I don't know how many soldiers were dead at that point when you first started putting on the production. Now we're well over 500 into this occupation. More relevant than ever.
Yeah, and I just found out yesterday, a friend of mine is a veteran that lives in Los Angeles, works for veterans groups, and he brought a whole group of veterans to the show the other night, and they said they loved it. And that for me is a real great review, because one of the ways I think that people try to distort the truth is, you know, this whole idea that to be against the war is to be against the soldiers, which is couldn't be farther from the truth for all the people that worked on this play.
Are you endorsing a candidate?
No, I'm going to wait till the dust settles.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tim Robbins is our guest, and that does it for today's show. If you want a copy, 1-800-881-2359. democracynow.org is our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Shufa Badal-Kudus, Mike Burke, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.